Welcome to Preschool and Beyond, a podcast where we tackle some of the most common and the most challenging issues facing preschool-age children and their families. Recording from Discovery Child Development Center is your host, Mike DeLaude.
Hi, and welcome to episode 33 of Preschool and Beyond, Understanding ADHD. Identifying signs of ADHD in preschoolers can be challenging. After all, things like impulsivity, distractibility, and difficulty sitting still are common among preschoolers. How can we determine which of these behaviors are age-appropriate and which ones are early signs of ADHD? If you suspect your child may have ADHD or has been diagnosed, how can you as a parent help establish structures and routines to help your child thrive? Today with us we have Brendan Mahan. Brendan is an ADHD executive function consultant, coach, and speaker. Brendan works with clients to troubleshoot and redesign their lives to help overcome some of the challenges having ADHD presents. He's also the host of the new successful podcast, ADHD Essentials. Welcome to our show, Brendan.
Thanks, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing well. We're really excited to have you on. This is a topic I've wanted to have for a while on here. I know a lot of parents are interested. It affects a lot of families, including my own. So we're really excited to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here. And preschool is a familiar age group for me. I do workshops on ADHD, and I've done them at every grade level from preschool through college. So I get the preschool side of stuff. I'm a former teacher, so I've worked with I was a middle school teacher, but I've between summer. Oh, cool. Yeah. So, and between just the nature of working in schools, like you get exposed to every grade. I started at fifth grade for a year, and then I was a middle school guy after that. And I've also been a summer camp counselor and kids just in every frame that you can think of. So I've worked with plenty of preschoolers by way of summer camp. And then I have identical twin sons who are 8 years old, and it's not that long ago that they were in preschool. So this is an age group I'm pretty excited to talk about.
Excellent. So let's just start off and kind of define, because I think, it's not always what people think it is. So right. How would you define ADHD, and what are kind of those most common symptoms associated with it?
So ADHD is a developmental disorder. And what that means is it's a neurological developmental disorder. So what that means is the brain of a person with ADHD is not developing as quickly as someone who is neurotypical. Currently, they're throwing out 30%. So it's lagging about 30% behind a typical brain. General rule, because 30% can be hard to calculate, a year or two, depending on the age of the kid, is a pretty safe bet. In preschool, maybe a year works. Kind of, it's a little tricky at the preschool age, which I'm sure we'll get into. So I'll jump to symptoms and we can talk about what ADHD looks like in preschool after that.
Sounds good.
But the symptoms are typically attention, obviously. That's a pretty key one. The name attention deficit hyperactive disorder is terrible and inaccurate because it does have a lot to do with attention, but it's not a deficit of attention. It's more an inability to regulate your attention. And you could think about that in terms of if you and I are talking to each other, and while I'm talking to you, you're staring at your phone. It's not that you don't have attention. You don't have a deficit of attention. You're just not paying attention to me, right?
Right.
You're not regulating that attention and putting it where it should be, unless for some reason the phone is an emergency, but probably it's Twitter or something. So the ADHD brain, people with ADHD struggle to regulate their attention, to pay attention to what they need to pay attention to. And that hyperactivity side in the name also doesn't work because not everybody with ADHD has the hyperactivity. There's plenty of us that only have inattentive. Right. And they're just a little spacey. They're not hyperactive. They're not bouncing off the walls. They're just not tuned in. It's a disorder. I'll give you that. So in terms of symptoms, we're looking at inattention and a difficulty regulating your attention. We're potentially looking at hyperactivity, that increased movement, increased thinking sometimes, just which leads straight to anxiety, fidgetiness. Often there's an inability to regulate your emotions. There's difficulty with planning. A major component is how people with ADHD interact with time and relate to time. They have trouble recognizing time for what it is. So with ADHD, an hour is not always an hour, and a minute is not always a minute. Sometimes a minute feels like an hour, and sometimes an hour feels like a second. It depends on how engaging the task is. And while that happens to everybody, for ADHD, it's more severe.
Yeah.
So that's a few of the symptoms.
No, that's good. I think the way you described is really good, that it can take many different forms. I think some people, when they hear ADHD, they think of a kid running around class, you know, can't sit at all, which could be, you know, someone that very well has it, but you also might have, you know, someone sitting there pretty nicely in their seat, but dozes off, you know, is dreaming, maybe fidgeting a little bit. Then the other part I thought was really important is when you're talking about attention, and it's not that they don't have the attention. Like sometimes you'll get, I know a misconception is, you know, my child doesn't have ADHD because they can play with Legos for 2 straight hours. And, you know, there is that element of that hyper-focus where they can pay attention to what's novel to them or exciting to them or something that they really like, but you know, when their attention needs to be somewhere else, they have a harder time.
Right. Yeah. And another element of the ADHD attention that's important to know about is that it just works differently than people who are neurotypical. So a neurotypical person's attention is a lot like a flashlight. They kind of shine it where it needs to be, and they pay attention to the thing they need to pay attention to. And a person with ADHD has an attention that's a lot more like a candle, where it's kind of lighting up everything. And they have to actively work to filter out all of the noise in a way that other folks don't. So, and you can see that in preschool, right? There's the kid who sits down and is doing the yarn and just right there with you or in the sensory box. And then there's the kid who is sort of in the sensory box and is sort of paying attention to the kid with the yarn and is sort of also taking his shoes on and off and fiddling with his toes, and he's not really in any one place. His focus and attention isn't in any one spot. And that's the kid who gets distracted and often distracts others because put your shoes on, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I remember once with my son, taking him to soccer when he was pretty young, and you know, some of them have like 5 different games going on at the same time. So you hear a whistle, you hear a game that looks fun on another field. You know, for someone with ADHD, that can be a really tough situation when so many things are going on at the same time, and to get your attention where it needs to be.
Yes. And for parents with ADHD, of kids with ADHD, that's an area that's actually one of the easier things to help with. It's one of the pieces of low-hanging fruit, right? Because to some degree, we can control the environment. If you want to have a nice quality time with your kid and you want to take him out to dinner, don't go to Buffalo Wild Wings, because it's just, there's too much happening there. There's too many, there's TVs, there's noise, there's sports, there's people cheering, there's a bar, there's all kinds of stuff. Go to like a Bertucci's or a quiet restaurant that's a little calmer. They're going to be more tuned in. They're going to maybe be able to tell you about their day and how awesome the clown was.
Yeah.
We can, to some degree, control those environmental stimuli.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And we'll talk in a little bit about some different strategies and just really ways that we can set our children up for success. Because if you know a situation is going to be really difficult, whether, you know, they have ADHD or not, you know, just in general, you want to set your kids up as best you can for success. So let's talk about the preschool level a little bit, because as I said at the top of the show, you know, it can be hard because preschoolers are impulsive. Preschoolers don't have as long of attention span as an elementary or middle school age child. But there are some signs early on where there could be, you know, indicators that we can diagnose it now or down the future, something that we want to keep an eye on. So what kind of red flags would you point out to parents who are wondering, you know, if their child may have or develop ADHD?
I want to start by saying red flags are a little hard at preschool because ADHD is developmental. Mm-hmm. So a preschool kid should be distracted. A preschool kid should have difficulty controlling their emotions. A preschool kid should be physically active, running around, making noise, screaming, and having difficulty sitting still. That's a thing that should be happening. So I don't want to come out and say those things that are at the middle school level are definitely indicators. At the preschool level, they're not, because that's what should be happening. At preschool, a lot of the time, it's about the degree to which those behaviors, those traits are impacting the kid and the people around the kid. By and large, I tend to say, wait. I tend to be of the mind of, like, he's six, he's eight, he's four, he's whatever age, or let's wait a minute. But if that kid is a danger to himself or a danger to others, now we want to go and we want to talk to the pediatrician and we want to start looking at a diagnosis and some early intervention and figure out what's going on and what do we need to do. And by the way, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be ADHD.
Right.
Because there's plenty of things that look like ADHD that are not ADHD. A prime example of that is trauma. A kid who experiences trauma in the home can act out. And that acting out can look like ADHD. Or a kid who experiences trauma somewhere else, doesn't have to be in the home, it can be anywhere, may wind up acting out. That behavior that they act out with might look like ADHD. And so you might get what looks like a red flag for ADHD, but is actually something different. So we don't want to immediately jump to ADHD. We want to make sure we get a professional diagnosis and we consider what the options are. Because if it's trauma, for example, and we call it ADHD, we're not getting to the root of that problem. And that might mean the kid gets traumatized again.
Right.
That might mean that the child just isn't able to process whatever the trauma was. So we want to be, I want to be careful around jumping straight to a diagnosis.
Yep. Yeah. And at our school, we'll never diagnose, you know, we'll point out some things if we're concerned about that the parents will want to follow up on. One thing I'll always start to, I always ask about sleep. You know, cause that right. can have a big impact on what's going on in the classroom. So, and a lot of times, you know, we do see a good amount of students who are really sleep deprived or not getting as much sleep as they should. And sleep, you know, a lot of the symptoms when you're not getting enough sleep are similar to what you would see with ADHD.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, if parents, let's say in the pre-K year or going on to kindergarten, and we have, you know, seeing a lot of these types of symptoms and, you know, there's some concern with teachers and parents. What do you see as some of those early benefits of deciding to do that early intervention and get them whatever form of treatment that they think will be best for their child?
Skill building. The sooner you have the diagnosis, the sooner you can start to build those skills. And in some cases, the sooner you have the diagnosis, the sooner you feel motivated to start building those skills, because now you have a defined problem that you want to solve, right? And in the preschool years and the early elementary school years, a lot of those skills are parental skills. A lot of those skills are learning different ways to interact with your kid and learning new ways to ask them to do things, figuring out how to manage the environment as opposed to just taking your kid to Buffalo Wild Wings. Recognizing what body language says to your kid and that maybe your body language is a little more intense than you recognize it to be. And you can address that by just standing differently or using a different tone of voice. So at the age we're discussing, those skills are very often parent skills.
Yeah. And when you're going off to kindergarten, you want to set them up as much as you can for success, not just academically, but, you know, if it's something that's interfering with their relationship with their peers. Sometimes I've seen, you know, children who might not necessarily be aware of their body and might be destroying
right.
the child's next to them structure where, you know, there's no malicious intent there, but they're just not aware that they're about to knock something over that a child's worked really hard on.
Absolutely.
So there's all these things that you really want to think about. ADHD, I know, often is accompanied by something else. So it might be ADHD and anxiety or
oppositional defiance, right, yeah. depression.
Right. Yeah.
There's all kinds of stuff.
Yes. I knew you would know better than me what
bipolar disorder.
Yes. So you definitely just by looking at the ADHD, you might uncover some other things. And in terms of schooling, too, there might be some things that you would qualify for different types of support, which would be really good for certain kids to start off with that. I know we both talked about teaching middle school earlier. And, you know, I had those conversations in eighth grade with parents who, you know, at that point we recommended that they, you know, get additional support for their children. But it's a lot easier to do that in the preschool years or early elementary. And, you know, it has such a big impact then.
Right. Absolutely. And in preschool, if you've got a diagnosis, then it's also helping the preschool, because now the preschool knows that we've got a kid with a significant enough disability. We need to have two teachers in that room all the time, because we want to make sure that we're providing the needs, we're providing services and addressing needs that that kid has, as well as the other kids in the class. So we want, there's never going to be a time when there aren't two adults in that room, maybe three, maybe four adults in that room, depending on how many kids are there and that kind of stuff. Yeah. And we want to arm the people who are taking care of our children with that information, if at all possible. Another advantage to early intervention is that this kid will be explicitly taught certain skills, and those skills get taught at preschool anyway, right? Like sharing and not knocking over your friend's tower and all that stuff. Those things tend to get taught explicitly in preschool, but in early elementary school, they may or may not get taught depending on what school you're in and those sorts of things. And having a diagnosis, having an IEP or a 504, allows the school to know that this kid's going to need to be taught these skills more often than other children. And the other advantage to that is that it gives the adults working with that child a heads up to be a little more patient with what's going on and to be a little more understanding with the struggles and challenges that that kid might be going through, and that the delays are appropriate and to be expected given the disability.
Right. Yeah. And I know I have some bias as a preschool director here, but I think also it's really beneficial for them to attend preschool, because with ADHD, you do need those, you want to see those behaviors in multiple settings. So if it's something you're seeing at home, finding out what happens at school, is it something, you know, just like the environment at home that's causing these difficulties, or what happens when they go to school, and what's the teachers have worked, you know, they've worked with lots of different kids. What are they seeing in the classroom for your child?
Right. And the other advantage is just having the opportunity to get new data points, right? Like if at preschool, the kid will happily eat the chicken nuggets, but at home, they'll never do it. They never eat cooperatively. Well, you can ask the preschool teacher, what are you doing differently? What are you doing that I'm not doing? It might be the way they ask. It might be that for some reason, this kid will happily eat it off an Elmo plate, but won't eat it off a white plate. Yeah. Or it might be that there's enough kids around that he's feeling engaged by that modeling. There could be any number of different reasons. But if you don't have an adult who isn't you interacting with your kid, you're not going to get a different perspective on your kid.
Yep. No, that's so true. So let's say there's a concern from the parents and from the school. ADHD might be the diagnosis, but we don't have one yet. So where should a parent of a 4 or 5 year old begin the process?
Your pediatrician. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Go straight to a medical professional who knows about ADHD. Start with your pediatrician. If your pediatrician doesn't feel comfortable in presenting this diagnosis, odds are in their network, they know people who are, and they're going to say, yes, this sounds like it might be ADHD. I'm going to refer you to Dr. Who's a Blatz. He knows all about it, and he'll help you figure out whether or not this is ADHD and what the proper next steps are.
Great. So once we have gone beyond there and we have a diagnosis, when you have someone so young, what types of treatment are available?
As an ADHD coach, I recommend coaching.
Yeah. I'm sure we have a lot of listeners who have never heard of an ADHD coach. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
So what I do is I work with people who are affected by ADHD, and I am a skill person, right? I'm working on building skills. I don't prescribe medication. That's not my jam. That's not my wheelhouse. I have people that I can refer you to for medication, but I don't do that myself. What I do is I help parents, one, understand what ADHD is and why their kids are making the decisions they're making and engaging in the behaviors they're engaging in based on that diagnosis. That by itself is a significant help, because all of a sudden we have understanding coming into the relationship. The patience increases, the judgment decreases, the problem solving increases. And I know you had Ross Green on the podcast not all that long ago. His problem solving model is beautiful. I use it all the time with my clients. So that's step one for me, is teaching parents about ADHD. And it takes anywhere from an hour to 2 hours. I mean, they have to pay me to be there, but I'm saving them months and months of reading books and watching videos and listening to podcasts and spending money and all that stuff. You're going to spend about the same amount of money on books that you would on me, and you get all the information in 2 hours. And then I move into skill building. Then I move into at the preschool age, it's really parent skill building. It's really helping the parent to understand why their kid's doing the thing they do and how to interact with them in a way that will get them to change that behavior. Very often it's being less direct. It's being, and by less direct, I mean, instead of just saying, go sit down, right? That very direct declarative statements, being a little more gentle about that. Hey, bud, I need you to go sit at the table. I need you to come over here. Gentler language helps the kid, because it's allows more time for processing, which gives them more time to manage their emotions and figure out what you just said. It makes it clear that you're going to be patient and going to give them some time, which helps them feel less intense and makes things feel less pressury. And that lets them manage the request more effectively. I also encourage parents to be more clear about expectations, right? And just repeat as necessary. When we sit down to dinner, the expectation is that everyone will be sitting at the table at the same time. And then we will all begin to eat. The expectation is that you will take a bite of every piece of food on your plate and try it. You might not finish it. You might not like it, but you're going to take one bite and swallow it, you know?
Yeah.
And if you fail to do that, then the consequence is whatever the consequence may be. Maybe it's no dessert.
Yeah.
Maybe it's you're not going to get to use the iPad, whatever makes sense. I often talk to parents. This is sort of my new philosophy that is working out pretty well. I talk to parents about how there's that notion that the punishment should fit the crime. And I don't like that. I rail against it. My new theory is that the consequence should fit the solution to the problem that arised, right? So if the kid isn't eating dinner because it's gross, that's one thing. Right? Because legitimately some food is gross to kids and they're not going to eat it. And that's a thing. But if they're not eating dinner because they chowed on a whole bunch of cookies for dinner, well, the consequence to that is that we're putting the cookies up high and they're going to be inaccessible. And you're not having a snack an hour or two before dinner because we want you to be hungry enough to eat your dinner. We want you to eat the healthy food. That consequence addresses the problem. We're not just telling the kid they have to go to their room and sit there because they didn't eat their broccoli. That consequence, that punishment doesn't have anything to do with not eating broccoli. It doesn't encourage a kid to eat broccoli or solve the problem of broccoli.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's really good. And I think that's really one of the benefits too of working with an ADHD coach, is kind of finding that kind of sweet spot where you want to make sure that you're challenging them appropriately, having them do things that they are capable of doing, but also, you know, recognizing here's what ADHD is. So, you know, to ask them to, you know, you're going to sit in your chair for an hour and a half for dinner might not be realistic for your child. And the coach can help you do those.
And handling it in a way that has positive long-term consequences, but not negative long-term consequences, right? Mm-hmm. Because one thing that I remember from when I was a kid is, and it only happened to me once or twice, but I know some friends who had to deal with this all the time, where they wouldn't eat something on their plate, right? And mom or dad would make them sit there until they finished it.
Yeah.
All you're doing is creating a power struggle that doesn't need to be there. And that power struggle continued with those friends of mine all the way through high school into college, because you're establishing that this relationship is more of a power dynamic than a loving and caring dynamic that's going to help make things go a little more smoothly in the long run. If my kid doesn't like something on the plate, try it. Okay. Why don't you like it? Like, what's wrong with it? Maybe it's too bitter. Maybe it's the texture. Often it's the texture with my guys, which took us a little while to figure out.
Yeah.
But addressing what the issue is and figuring out a way around it for the next meal is useful.
Yeah, definitely. We talked when Tina Bryson was on a lot about chasing that why, figuring out like what was the motivation behind that child's behavior.
Yep.
And that can definitely go a long way. And kind of jumping off what you said too about the dinner table, last week we had Liz Weiss from Liz's Healthy Table, and she was talking about that, like how important having these positive experiences at the dinner table, and that can help with so many different things. And then if you're having that power dynamic you talked about a minute ago, you know, it's really not going to allow for those positive experiences to happen, which can go a long way for helping discipline problems, helping you forge a much stronger bond with your child.
Right. Yeah. And I'll leave the dinner table since that was all last week. I'll come up with a new example next time.
That's good. So let's talk a little bit about medication. Is there a certain age that you would say I would not give a child, you know, before age of 5, or have you seen it be effective for some younger children?
Medication is rarely diagnosed for younger children, sort of as a broad statement, right? Mm-hmm. When it is, usually it's because the kid's impulsivity is a danger and is a risk. Mm-hmm. And we want to get that under control. And the quickest way to do that potentially is through medication. That said, preschool age, early elementary, I'm not comfortable with medication this young. And a lot of that is because so much of ADHD is developmental. Mm-hmm. That maybe they're going to grow out of it. You know, maybe it's not even ADHD. Maybe they're just that part of their brain is not there yet. So if they're safe, I'm inclined to say wait off on medication until we get to like late elementary school, middle school age, just to see where the chips land.
Right.
But I want to reiterate, medication is not my jam. I am not a prescriber. I'm not a pharmacist. I'm not a doctor. My background is education. I have a master's in education and I have a master's in school in counseling.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm a skills guy.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there could be an argument for either way on this question. You know, you talked about some more extreme, if, you know, you're really worried that, you know, your child just, you know, has a really hard time controlling their body, might run out into the street and, you know, medication you feel might save your child's life. That can be one thing, or there's just so many issues going on in school. But even that said, medication, whether it's early on, later on, is not a complete solution to anything. And you need those skills, whether or not, you know, you have the best medication in the world. And, you know, there are research on some really effective drugs that will help kids, but them alone is not going to conquer ADHD. They are going to need those skills no matter what medication you're taking.
Right. Yeah. And the medication might make building the skills easier.
Right.
But it's not going to teach skills.
Yes. Absolutely. So parents, obviously, you talked about earlier, are so critical at every stage, but especially at this one, to really help set systems up for their child and develop those skills that are so important. So can you give just like a couple of I know every child's different, but just some like good practices for parents to kind of make the environment more ADHD friendly?
Clear expectations. Like I said earlier, if you're going to Target and your kid is not doing the best job of staying with you at Target, on the way to Target, you want to talk about how, all right, now when we get there, the expectation is that you're going to be within 3 steps of the cart for the entire time that we're at Target. And if you're able to do that, we can go look at the books or look at the toys and hang out there for a little while before we go home. We're not necessarily going to buy anything, but we can pick a look and see what's there. You get 3 shots on goal, and then we're just going to leave. That's the consequence, right?
Yep.
And then you get to target. On the way into target, you go through that process again, because now they've heard it at least twice. You probably said it at home too before you left. And then when you first get to target and you're walking around, a couple times you just kind of stop the cart and you look at the kid. This is whenever they drift a little too far early on, and you go, how many steps away do you think you are?
Yeah.
And then they take their, they maybe they guess and then they step, or maybe they just count the steps as they go. You want to do this so that they are successful a couple times. And then you want to do it at a time when they're going to mess it up and have them mess it up and go. And that time you want to go, all right, next time's going to be 1, so that they know that now, like, game on. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
Now you got your 3.
Yeah.
And, you know, be careful with it. You don't want to just, because you also want to finish your shopping.
Yeah.
So if they're trying to stay close and trying to do it the right way, then maybe you steer the cart towards them a little bit.
Yeah, right.
Every now and then, you know, like, you can control the environment. And so you've made those expectations clear, and you're also helping them. Yeah. Another really strong strategy is counting. Counting is beautiful. And this is the 1, 2, 3 magic stuff. Where, like I just mentioned, you get 3 shots on goal, you get 3 times to mess up, and then there's a consequence for whatever the case may be. And that counting to 3 lets them correct their behavior, right? Because there isn't a consequence until you get to 3. So 1 and 2 lets them, you know, push the envelope and challenge authority a little bit, and also lets them learn and correct their behavior as we go. But once they get to 3, that consequence has to happen.
Right.
The flip of counting is, I have identical twin sons. Like, I was often the only person taking care of them, right? I was a teacher. So in the summer, it was me and 2 kids who were 2 and 3 years old. So what I would do is I would say, I need 2 boys in the car by the time I count to 5, or I need 2 boys counting their teeth by the time I count to 6, or I'm sorry, 2 boys brushing their teeth by the time I count to 6. And then I would just count, and they would invariably complete the task that I assigned to them before I finished counting. So that's a really good strategy. And eventually you let the kids pick the number. You're like, I need 2 boys in the backyard by the time I count to, what should I count to? And they're like, 1,000,000. And you go, okay, 100,000, 200,000. And they're like, what?
Yeah.
But that counting is really effective. And the best part about that is, my guys are 8 now. They brush their teeth when we ask them to brush their teeth. They get in the car when I ask them to brush their car, because that stuff, I trained them with the counting. But if they don't, if they're slacking and I go, I need 2 boys brushing their teeth, by the time I count to 6, they're often brushing their teeth.
Yeah.
Because it triggers that, like, 4-year-old response in them.
Yeah.
And gets them going.
Yeah, no, I use numbers a lot for different things and counting. And, like, I have a 4-year-old, and if I tell him, go clean up the family room, you know, that can be overwhelming to a child. If I tell him, okay, let's see, can you pick up 15 items? You know, he'll pick up 15 and he'll usually go above it. All right, now I have, and we'll count. Now I have 20. Now you have 25. And, you know, his older brothers will join in sometimes too. And then,
yep, you know,
it's picked up in a few minutes versus if I said, come on, clean everything up. You know,
yeah,
that's hard for any child, an ADHD child even more, you know.
Right.
You're going to lose interest in that task. But if you tell them, here's how many, you know, it's active. They're counting. They're moving.
And it's not just active. It's overwhelming to go in and clean the living room, right? Like, they don't know where to start. Yep. They don't know what to do.